They say plants like music.
Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. He's Jean-Lit Foot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunch Berry.
No!
No one steals my Crunch Berries.
I think you mean my Crunch Berries. Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.
Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait. You look and sound just like me. I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money.
A lot less. I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV starting at just $40 a month.
Everything great about me, but for less money?
Which makes me greater, don't you think? Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit sling.com to see your offer.
Sling. Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, a weekly geeky squeak of interesting links that have caught my attention, and then usually an interview at the end of the show. Spring has sprung here in Berlin. There are church bells ringing in the background, and I don't know how long they're going to go on for. So apologies for that, but I just sort of, you have to start recording at some point. I am Christian Giller. You can talk to me at Chris Chidge on Twitter or find more contact details at chrisgiller.com. First, I will present a series of geek culture links that have interested me over the past week, and we have quite a plethora this time around. And then I have an interview with Jay Kwon of Tendermint, a blockchain project in quote marks. And if you listen to the interview, you'll understand why I present that as quote marks. They don't necessarily think of themselves as a completely 100% conventional blockchain, but I'll leave that up to you to decide when you hear the interview. First, an article on The Guardian from Ciaran Cale entitled "How I Accepted I'm an Introvert and Learned to Refuse Invitations Without Guilt." This was, this was an article that caught my eye as part of a series of articles that have come out recently, maybe all on The Guardian, I can't quite remember, about levels of introvert versus extrovert and how maybe our understandings of those terms are not quite what we initially thought. That as not hardly surprising that introvert and extroverted are not necessarily two extremes, but it's on a scale. And you kind of have almost a pot of extroversion that once exhausted, you need to be an introvert for a while and etc. And that was something that I could understand. That's certainly how I feel. Sometimes I feel very sociable and then I just switch off and I just want to be on my own. And then I can be fine again the next day. I think the thing that caught my eye the most in this was that I do suffer from FOMO, fear of missing out, quite a lot. I do always wish I could accept everything, but sometimes I just don't feel like it. Not to the extremities of the author of this article, but yeah, I didn't necessarily want to jump on the bandwagon of disconnecting from social media and not knowing what people are doing and things like that. But I do appreciate that sometimes feels like makes you feel like you should be doing more than you really need to be doing. And that can cause some anguish. So the main point of this article, though, is to sort of realize this and to get your friends around you to realize this and not be offended if you always say no to things. And this is difficult. I think you'd have to have a very strong group of friends that you've known for a long time, because if you're always going to say no to things, I mean, how do you ever hang out with those people, I guess, is my main issue with this perspective. And it seems partially selfish, maybe, that if you always say no, what if those people need you? What if they wanted you to come, et cetera, et cetera? So I'm not 100% sure if I really agree with the article itself, but I agree with the discussion around these sorts of issues, and that's why I brought it up. And yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on introversion, extroversion, etc. Next, we're talking about people. This is an extremely long article. Let's see, what does Medium say? 30 minutes. by Duncan A. Sabian on how the Magic the Gathering color wheel explains humanity. Magic the Gathering, highly successful card game from Richard Garfield, who's also produced many other games. In fact, he has a new game out now that is on the road to being just as successful, Keyforge. I haven't played Magic the Gathering ongoing for quite some time. I think the first or second edition, but also remains very, very successful today. And in the game are five colors, and any of you who are sci-fi or fantasy fans will recognize these colors as fairly typical sort of a fantasy and sci-fi tropes: chaos, order, nature, etc., etc. But this article, I mean, I must admit, it's so long and goes into so much depth. I did switch off a little bit at a certain point. I almost felt like there was too much detail on this that was strictly necessary. But if the sound of using a game mechanic, and I would probably guess a reasonably loosely in the first place created game mechanic, to explain pretty much the entire human race, then this could be the article for you. But maybe you'll also see it as a slightly trite way of treating human psychology. I'm not 100% sure, but it's certainly an interesting read, if a lengthy one. If you know Magic the Gathering or not, it really doesn't matter. He actually has lots of other examples of where the characters on these spectrums can be found in other fantasy, sci-fi, and popular culture references, including some that I didn't actually understand what they were, to be honest with you. But still, so read with trepidation, but read if any of that sounded interesting to you. Going off at a complete tangent here, and this is not a new article, but the Weekly Squeak is not always about new articles, it's about articles I read in the past week. This was an article on History Extra from Cem Dudusu. I'm not sure if it's a Turkish name, as relates to the topic, so I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce it. Six things you probably didn't know about the Ottoman Empire. Why am I suddenly talking about the Ottoman Empire? Well, after our recent trip to Greece, I was reading a lot around the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and those kind of empires that all started to crumble around the beginning of the 20th century. I've been to lots of former areas of the Ottoman Empire, and it's always fascinated me that an empire that stood for so long, and yet some of the vestiges of it now are, to me anyway, fairly minor. Things like some common food and drinks, but they all reverted back to Christianity very quickly. They went back to their own languages very quickly. I'm not 100% sure how things were run under the empire, but it always struck me as people moved on very quickly, and that struck me as quite interesting. And Turkey now is a country, much like other countries that have had empires, that is sort of coming to terms with its former glory, shall we say, and some of the problems in that can cause in modern culture. So the Ottoman Empire was a large and very long-standing empire, and yet a lot of people don't know too much about it. So I would encourage you to have a read of this if you're interested in history at all. And here's a couple of my sort of choice things you didn't know from the article. Ottomans and Turks are not the same. In fact, the Ottoman Empire was comprised of many, many different cultures. They took over lots of the regions we now call the Balkans, who are predominantly white, sometimes Christians. So So not necessarily Turks, as we may think of them. In their long history, they had plenty of defeats, especially at the hands of Napoleon, who was another big power. So this empire lasted nearly 500 years, from the late 1400s up until the beginning of the 20th century in various leases of life. So, you know, they certainly had their ups and downs. And I guess, again, I reiterate the sheer longevity of this empire, right up to the beginning of the First World War, pretty much, which is quite amazing. And I've just started reading a new book that talks about a very particular part of the Ottoman history. So I may have more to cover on the subject soon. Switching back to technology, which is usually my main focus of this podcast, but we haven't had so much so far. Two articles here. One that jumped out at me because it's something that I have mentioned, I think, in the past. And I love kind of sci-fi fantasy interfaces. This is an article from Tom Ward, my real name namesake, on Wired. The title of the article is "The Mind Behind Minority Report Giving PowerPoint a Sci-Fi Overhaul." This is an article about John Unterkofler, trying to resist pronouncing it the German way, who was responsible for creating a lot of sci-fi and fantasy film interfaces in Hollywood, including the one in Minority Report. And so inspired by this, he actually ended up creating a company that is attempting to build products just like that. Now, this is interesting because I read a book many years ago that I have recommended, I think, several times on this podcast called Make It So, about sci-fi interfaces. And in that book, it claimed that the Minority Report interface was based on a pre-existing project, but that it was impractical because moving your arms above your heart is so exhausting, and Tom Cruise during filming had to take lots of rests for this. So yes, there was inspiration into this this product, this interface, from academia, but I actually thought it was a more active product. It's hard to know. I mean, the book is older than his article, so who knows? But what was interesting is how John Unterkofler has ended up working on many products out of his fantasy things that he created in Hollywood, which I find quite fascinating. Is also the sort of main point of this book that I mentioned, the Make It So book, how Hollywood and fiction more broadly, but I guess Hollywood because it's so visual, has inspired real things and vice versa. So I found this article quite fascinating, and how they are now prototyping this kind of G-Speak is the main project for meetings and presentations in business, which is unfortunately a somewhat boring application of it, but that's where the money is. And the writer actually prototyped this, and it works moderately well so far. So it's quite fascinating. I don't know how you get over this apparent issue with raising arms above your heart, but I guess meetings don't tend to be that long. And maybe it's another impetus to keep meetings short. So it can only be a good thing. So if sci-fi fantasy interfaces and the influence on the real world are your thing, then I highly recommend you take a read of this. And finally, an article on 1-0 by Jesse Drew Davis, something that is becoming, unfortunately, increasingly relevant to me, an article titled "The Planned Obsolescence of Old Coders." And this is something that has been mentioned in the past. This writer is not the first person to bring this up, but how in the discussions of diversity, we often forget one group, and that is age. Many companies, not all, do tend to skew to the younger crowd. This is not strictly true. I know we have mentioned this on the show before about how some companies, the average age is actually in the 40s, not in the 30s or less than 30s, as many people think. But I guess the younger ones tend to get the glory a lot, maybe. I'm not sure if that, I don't know, it's hard to say. And especially as we're now living longer, I mean, a lot of us are now living in countries where pension systems will not support us, pretty much never anticipating having a pension. So I'm kind of prepared to work at least into my 70s, I would guess, if not until the very end, we will have to be more open to older people in the workforce. And granted, older people can be stale and set in their ways, but older people can also bring lots of experience. And how we integrate those older people into the workforce is effectively. And I guess, especially if you're rejoining a workforce after children, after a change of career, etc., how someone who has commitments, a mortgage, children, a lifestyle, can progress up a career ladder, especially when the tech world is infamous for its flat hierarchies. Often you have to go into management, which is not what everybody wants to do, especially developers who tend to have issues with communication, shall we say. Being a manager may not be the best fit for them. So how do you fit older people who want more but can also give more into this workforce? And I guess on the flip side, keep that older workforce motivated, fresh, up to date, inquisitive, etc. I personally know, as I'm getting older myself, it's very easy to stay set in your ways, and you have to almost force yourself on a regular basis to discover new things and be flexible and change all the time. So how do we bake that into companies as well without sort of making it sound offensive? That's an interesting topic, actually. And Kate and I, Kate, my old ex-host from this show, we used to run a charity a long time ago in Australia where we were dealing with lots of people who rented in protected housing, government housing, and a vast majority of the people in that housing was older women. And that compounds, obviously, two underrepresented groups into one there, an even bigger kind of problem to counter and to think about. But yeah, let's not discount age. I have mentioned this many, many times at events, actually, as I'm now increasingly, and I'm not even 40 yet, so I'm still, and nevertheless, increasingly the oldest person in the room at many events now. So I'm starting to feel this, and I'm nowhere near some of the people mentioned in this article. So let's start to sort of plan for this now, I guess. That was my links for the week. We had games and how they match psychology. We had fantasy technology. We had history. We had old people. I mean, we had everything that interests me right now, I would pretty much say. And next in the show is an interview I conducted with Jay Kwon of Tendermint. Tendermint and Cosmos are two blockchain-related projects that I've had my eye on for quite some time. So when the interview opportunity came up, I jumped at it. It's interesting, as you'll find in the interview, they're sort of learning a lot from the traditional state machine that is often used in a distributed application and making it fit into the blockchain space and borrowing the positives of both sides and a couple of the negatives, but a lot of the positives. So I would say out of a lot of the projects that I encounter in this space, it's good because they're most aware of their history and what they can borrow from existing examples. And that I found quite interesting and quite welcoming. And the company has raised funds. The company has just released onto mainnet, I guess the blockchain equivalent of maybe an alpha or a beta. So they're actually making some good, solid technical and product decisions. And so I found speaking to Jay quite interesting. And I hope you do too.
My name is Jay. I graduated from Cornell with a bachelor's of science in computer science. And since then, I came to Silicon Valley to work on various startup companies. At first, I joined Yelp, where I built the Yelp app, and then soon after caught the startup bug and decided to become an entrepreneur. And in 2008, the financial crisis happened, and got me wondering how we can reimagine the financial system, because everything seemed so arbitrary and arguably broken. And later on, around 2013, I discovered Bitcoin. And this was right after the Snowden revelations, when I got interested in cryptography and started hacking on a few crypto projects. So when Bitcoin came around to the mainstream, I got really excited and decided I wanted to pursue a career full time there. And around, you know, it was pretty clear from the beginning by reading through some of the materials that I found that proof of work was projected to become a problem. And so I've been doing a lot of trading in my spare time, just trying to predict the future, and this kind of clicked a bell in my head, rang a bell in my head, and I realized, yeah, Bitcoin, here's a big secret that no one really seems to understand, which is that proof of work needs to be replaced by something else. Hmm. I didn't find anything for a while. And so I was working on an exchange software, but one day reading through some of the academic papers behind paywalls, I found a set of papers on Byzantine consensus algorithms that laid out all the components necessary to solve the problem. And so I dropped everything and started working on Tendermint in 2014. Mm-hmm. So that's my background.
The main kind of tagline you see on the Tendermint website when you come to it is Byzantine fault-tolerant state machine replication, or blockchain for short. This obviously will grab people's attention. So what is Tendermint? Is Tendermint a blockchain? Is it not? Is it an alternative to? What actually is it, and why would someone want to use it, I guess, as a follow-up question to that?
Sure. Great question. So Tendermint is, it's exactly what it says. It's a Byzantine fault-tolerant state machine replication engine. And we say that because we tried to, and we have, abstracted out the consensus algorithm such that it can be plugged into any state machine. So a state machine, you can think of it as it's a deterministic state machine. So it's think of it as a virtual computer that has storage and processing capability and some kind of logic. And every time you feed it a message or a transaction, it mutates the state somehow, right? So that's the general concept of just about any computer or program. And Tendermint is able to connect to such any such application using a very simple protocol to mutate the state of that program. How Tendermint works is a Tendermint process connects to many other Tendermint processes through the internet. They don't have to be connected point to point. So this works on a gossip level. So they just need to be somehow connected weekly. And it's assumed that there's a set of signers who are responsible for coming to consensus about blocks. And in Tendermint, a block is it's just a list of transactions, similar to Bitcoin or any other blockchain out there. And once a block is finalized, Tendermint will push the transactions in that block to the application and tell it to process it. The application tells Tendermint the resulting Merkle hash root, and then Tendermint puts that back into the blockchain. It's an engine. It's designed. So Tendermint isn't really a blockchain. It's maybe half a blockchain. It really provides the blockchain structure. It provides peer-to-peer networking, and it has the Tendermint consensus algorithm implemented. It has RPC endpoints, but you still need to provide the application logic. A really simple way to do that is to build on the Cosmos SDK, which is a software development kit. It's a framework that imports Tendermint. So it's got the consensus engine built in there, and it's got a lot of the struts needed to really easily create a blockchain application in Go language.
So actually digging a little bit into the use case here, because I think I can go off into two directions from this question. So a lot of distributed applications need a state machine. But if I go to the first page of your documentation, it says Tendermint serves blockchain applications. So why only blockchain applications? And could I use this as a state store in non-blockchain applications? Like, why is this specific to blockchain applications, and why couldn't I use it in just a a microservice, a standard Web2 microservice-based application?
I suppose you could, but what Tendermint designs for is it's optimized for batching transactions into blocks. Mm-hmm. So there's a cost to having many signers, validators. We call them validators. They're equivalent or analogous to Bitcoin miners. Mm-hmm. But instead of using proof of work, you're using cryptography to sign off. So think of it as maybe like authenticated Raft or something like that. Mm-hmm. Except it's Byzantine fault tolerant, not just fault tolerant. And the more signers you have, the more necessarily the more time it takes to gather all those signatures. And so in order to amortize the time required to come to consensus, it makes sense to batch transactions into blocks. And that's why Tendermint is implemented as a blockchain, or at least provides blockchain structure. Mm-hmm. So one could use Tendermint on a single node. It'll work fine on a single node, you may not care for the latency. Yeah. Because it's optimized for there being many signers. You could also run it with 2, 3, but you wouldn't get any Byzantine fault tolerance out of it until you get you have 4 nodes that are replicated.
Okay, sure. That makes complete sense. It's probably a leading question. I mean, yeah, that's always the unique selling point. Sorry?
That was the easy question.
Yeah. Well, it's always the unique selling point of a blockchain, in quote marks, is for that more finessed validator, as you call it, model, whereas other consensus algorithms are more just about checking we've got a consensus here, not necessarily validating the consensus in the same way as a blockchain. Maybe that's so the follow-up question to that is, so is Tendermint a private or public, in quote marks, blockchain?
Ooh, okay. Interesting question. So it's designed really for both. It's designed at least so that we can use what I call classical Byzantine fault tolerant algorithms, so non proof of work consensus algorithms, namely the Tendermint consensus algorithm. It's designed to work in a public setting, so that's why it's got various optimizations, like it splits the block into parts and uses a BitTorrent-like protocol to very quickly propagate it to everyone. It uses a multi-core concurrent architecture. That's why it's implemented in Golang, actually, so that it's able to quickly gossip the necessary votes to its peers. It's designed to work in a public setting, although you do need, your application needs to be able to handle validator membership changes, right? So Tendermint by itself doesn't know how to mutate the signer set. Maybe in the future we'll add that as a module. But right now what it does is it relies on the application to tell Tendermint how to change the set of signers and what their relative voting powers are. So that's one caveat. But as long as you have that, and you get that when you build on the Cosmos SDK. The SDK has a staking module, so you can create a public blockchain with a proof of stake security with staking tokens. You can still use Tendermint in a private setting. So if you just don't want to mutate the set of signers, or if you don't want to use a staking token, but you want to use some kind of permissioned layer where you, maybe there's a whitelist or some other process for determining who the signers are, then you can do that as well. And there's no reason why a public system like this can't work in a private setting, because it doesn't rely on proof of work. So there's no security disadvantages.
Okay. And let's actually dig into what you do offer to developers, because actually Looking at the list at a top level, and we can talk a little bit more detail about some of them, it looks like you offer some of the things that some other blockchains struggle with a little bit, or maybe you just make them easier, I guess. So firstly, just looking down the list I can see here, starting with the first one, ABCICLI. I mean, I know what a CLI is. What's an ABCICLI? What's that?
So ABCI stands for, it's a strange acronym. I think it stands for Application Blockchain Interface, but there are other interpretations of it as well. It just sounds nice. But I think it's the most similar analogy might be like CGI between like the Apache web server and WordPress or so. So Tendermint provides the consensus logic. And once a block is committed, it will push that block and all the transactions to the application via a socket protocol, kind of like CGI does. And we call that ABCI. It uses protobuf underneath, and it streams the transactions to the application. And what it expects back as a response is return codes for each transaction. So whether the transaction succeeded or not, as well as a final Merkle hash from the app, so that we can do things like Merkle proofs. But in from a high level point of view, it's as simple as you can think of it as just pushing the block to the app and getting responses back.
Okay. And actually, so you very briefly mentioned upon the next feature I was going to ask about there, which is something that some other blockchains, especially some of the best known ones, can make difficult, if not impossible, but difficult, which is subscribing to events through standard WebSockets, which is obviously something most applications want to do. But some other blockchains like Ethereum make it a little harder or a little non-standard, shall we say, whereas a WebSocket is a very standard way. And I'm guessing you already mentioned Protobuf, but I'm guessing the WebSocket subscription is pretty much what any developer would expect if they'd used anything else that use WebSockets?
So the ABCI socket connection is not, it's not a WebSocket. It's just a pure, there are two implementations. One is just pure Go, so no socket at all, but just in memory. Another is using TCP/IP without WebSockets. So there's a separate RPC system where you can subscribe to WebSockets and listen to events. So that's how a developer should interact with the blockchain through Tendermint's RPC system. But this ABCI socket is a bit separate. A developer who wishes to develop an application that connects to Tendermint, that blockchain application. Number one, it needs to be deterministic. So it needs to be able to come to the exact deterministic same Merkle route based on the previous history of transactions, right? So it's a different way of developing an application. It's not exactly the same as most WebSocket application development because you have to be careful about how you handle concurrency and such. The simplest way to develop a Tendermint application is to just not have any concurrency at all and just use like a single thread. You're not using WebSockets. You're using it's a different kind of system. And then if you need to listen to events that were generated by your application, so as well as events that are generated from within Tendermint, like whether was a block committed or did this transaction, did a new transaction go through, and listening to all the return events provided by the application to Tendermint, then you can you can subscribe to a WebSocket onto Tendermint to listen to those. So there are two connections here. One is between Tendermint and the app, the deterministic blockchain app. And then there's another application maybe outside of this blockchain system that is ultimately using the blockchain. So if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And it also looks like you add some form of querying events too. You call it indexing, I guess, maybe in some in SQL type systems, they might call it views. In some other systems, you might call it projections, this ability to be able to sort of pre-create a query on what you're interested in finding out and then subscribing to that filtered feed of events. Is that pretty much correct or have we got that wrong?
With MySQL or SQL views.
Don't necessarily pay too much attention to my analogies, but.
Well, with Tendermint, you can. Every time you process every time the blockchain application processes a transaction, it can tell Tendermint the response code, which tells Tendermint like whether it succeeded or not, and if it failed, why, with errors and logs. But the application can also tell Tendermint a list of tags. And so using these tags, you can search for historical transactions by querying for those tags. So it's maybe the initial iteration of an indexing system to make it easy to fetch events, but I'm sure we'll be continuing to improve that so we can do things like plug in geospatial indexing and such.
Yeah. Okay. You're adding some features that, especially in a state machine, people will want, but actually some other blockchains make somewhat hard to accomplish. So it's pretty useful things to make it much more useful in kind of in quote marks standard traditional applications, I guess. I've worked on comparable state machines in more standard distributed applications, and these are the sorts of features that they tend to have. So you know they're useful and they're known and they're understandable by developers. And making it quite useful. I'm just going to have a quick look down the ecosystem page you have, because this is obviously lowers the barrier of entry to any developer interested. So your official SDKs are Go or RPC, I guess, and then you have a series of community SDKs that people have contributed, or are there other official SDKs as well?
I think the most fleshed out ones, I guess we can call it official because we're currently most heavily promoting it, is Cosmos SDK, written in Go. And that compiles in Tendermint, so it doesn't even use a socket for ABCI. It just uses Go interfaces and allows you to develop an application in Go. But there's also Lotion, which is a funny name, but it's a JavaScript-based application that works with Tendermint. And for various languages, people have been developing different bindings to Tendermint. For anyone who wants to develop different bindings, I would recommend looking at all the tooling that we've built into the SDK, the Cosmos SDK in Go, because there are many aspects to developing a blockchain application on Tendermint that the SDK solves for the user, like things like providing a storage system. By the way, the storage system in the Cosmos SDK is great. So like in Ethereum, for example, they have storage, but everything's like 32 by 32. And you can't iterate on the store, so you can't iterate sequentially on the key, which makes certain things more inefficient to implement. Whereas the storage system in Go has it's not based on the Patrice tree, but it's based on a different kind of Merkle tree, called an AVL tree, and you're able to iterate. And so we take advantage of that a lot in implementing our staking system for the Cosmos Hub. There's just various other hooks and callbacks and things that are that make developing applications very easy in the Cosmos SDK.
So actually, just to clarify, because this is a nice transition into kind of my next series of questions, I've heard of Tendermint and I've heard of Cosmos. And so Cosmos is the Tendermint SDK, or is there another Cosmos? And this is a constant point of confusion.
Yeah. That's a good point. It is a bit confusing because the project started off as Tendermint, and then we created Cosmos after that. Now, Cosmos is it's not just the SDK. Cosmos is it's a concept, mm-hmm. kind of like the World Wide Web. Sorry, I don't know if I cut out there, but Cosmos is it's a concept of a network of blockchains, kind of like the World Wide Web is a network of computers. And so what we're doing with Cosmos is creating interoperable communication protocols between blockchains in the sense of maybe sidechains, except we're not using proof of work, but because everything is using Byzantine fault tolerant consensus algorithms, namely currently Tendermint, it makes this cross chain communication much more efficient. So, in other words, for two blockchains to communicate to each other securely, what you really need is for each blockchain to be a light client of the other. So, you need to be able to submit a transaction onto one blockchain that tells the blockchain that something happened on the source blockchain. You need to be able to prove to the destination, the target blockchain, that the source committed a block hash, and you need to be able to provide a Merkle proof or some proof that there's something in there in the state that is intended to be sent to the target blockchain. And so we call this IBC, or inter-blockchain communication, which is kind of analogous to TCP/IP. In fact, there are many similarities. For one, where it's based on like sequential packet communication, and it's being implemented right now. It's our current focus. But the idea, the idea with Cosmos is that it's a network of blockchains. The reason why we want a network of blockchains is so that we can scale the cryptocurrency and public blockchain and public and private blockchain system. So for example, through such a network, similar to the Bitcoin sidechain concept, you can move tokens from one blockchain to another via two-way pegging, which is a form of locking of tokens or collateralization. So you can use the same token in different blockchains, so you can move your pegged Ether, say, to zero knowledge blockchain and do something there and move it out, move it to another blockchain that might offer a different kind of virtual machine than the EVM, and so on. And this way, we can scale the cryptocurrency ecosystem and experience. So that's Cosmos. Just last week, we launched the Cosmos Hub, and that is a blockchain built on the Cosmos SDK, whose primary purpose is to connect to many other blockchains, especially those developed on the Cosmos SDK, but also in Lotion and other frameworks. And it's intended to function as kind of a common custodian or a common hub. So its job is to keep track of how many tokens are on each connected blockchain, right? So it's the beginning of a scaling and interoperability solution for the public blockchain space. That's Cosmos, and the Cosmos SDK. You know, we call it the Cosmos SDK because we really want to start promoting the Cosmos network. And if you build your application on the SDK, then you'll be able to simply import the IBC module and connect to the Cosmos Hub. So it's the easiest way to develop an application today that will be compatible with the entire Cosmos ecosystem.
Okay. And so just to clarify that, both Sendermin and Cosmos are pretty much worked on by the same team, or is it two separate teams? Or I mean, they're both fairly large projects, so by the sounds of them anyway.
Yeah, it is currently, it's, you know, we don't intend to remain the only maintainers or the primary the implementers. There's actually two entities involved here. One is Tendermint Inc. Mm-hmm. It's a Delaware C Corp, and it's the primary software provider for the foundation called the Interchain Foundation, based in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Which was responsible for the fundraiser, and its mission is to promote the Cosmos network. So they're two very closely related entities, but separate independent entities. Mm-hmm. And we're working with now many other companies to develop IBC. Mm-hmm. And Lotion is a different entity entirely.
Yep.
And all of these different frameworks are designed by different companies. So we really
for maximum scalability in the non-blockchain sense. That's what you need. If you're always the only maintainers, then it's going to be very hard to keep going at a rate you want to forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We want Tendermint and the SDK to be like bizarre projects, kind of like the Linux kernel and the Linux ecosystem. So yeah, that's what
exactly.
We want.
Yeah. So, I guess we're having this conversation a 5 days after a reasonably positive announcement. For some reason, I thought it was a month ago, but no, it's only 5 days ago. You just raised a Series A round as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you almost sounded surprised by that. Did we? Oh, yeah.
No, we definitely did.
Yeah. So actually, I want to dive to a latter part of this announcement before we go back to the main part. And the blog post you have that announces it calls out two particular use cases, a DEX with Binance and an ID project with the National Thai government, I guess, which are quite different from each other. I mean, which is interesting because so many of the really practical blockchain use cases are always currency based, which is fine, but you know, not always the most interesting. So something like an ID project is also quite interesting. And also a ticketing payment application. I just noticed that. Sorry. So, I mean, are any of these projects in production yet, or are they in late stage POCs, or how are those projects kind of going, and how's the experience been with them?
The national ID project in Thailand is it's been in development for a while. I believe they're in a beta testnet. The intent there is to go live and deploy it nationally, but they're not, you know, nationally deployed yet, but that's where they're going. It's not a currency project, but the idea and the intent of the Cosmos network and with IBC is to make it useful not just for tokens, but also, you know, general purpose message transfers. So we're not focusing on this right now, but, you know, in the future, and very soon, as soon as the IBC module is out, you can use it for things like cross-chain smart contract calls, but, you know, for any other need, really. That ID project isn't built on the SDK, but nevertheless, you can still create IBC compatibility with other frameworks. So that's where they're going. So eventually, they will connect to the Cosmos Hub as well, and use the Cosmos Hub for other features besides token transfers. Or maybe they'll use it for token transfers too. That's not clear yet.
And I'm guessing that's kind of with the intention of something like the Estonian ID card where you could use your identity to access multiple services, something like that, or?
I can't answer much on the exact use case of the application, but I imagine so,
Okay. And, I mean, $9 million is a reasonable amount. I'm not sure how big your team is to know how thinly that's spread out, but with that, what's now on the roadmap for the next 6 months, a year, et cetera?
That's $9 million for the Tenement Inc. But both the Tenement Inc. Delaware C Corp. as well as the foundation also has Atom tokens, which are the native staking token of the Cosmos SDK, and the foundation has funds from the 2017 fundraiser too. Mm-hmm. So we're not thinly spread out. We're okay.
I mean, in terms of more, just if you had like 300 staff or something.
Oh no. We're actually a pretty small team. So we're just 35 people.
Okay. About.
And sorry, what was your question?
So what are you going to do with it?
The immediate next step is we've just started, we kicked off the IBC process. So if you go to github.com/cosmos/ICS, there's some ongoing work there on specifying the IBC protocol. And so we'll be working there on GitHub. And that's our primary focus now is getting IBC going, and that'll take about a quarter or 3 months or so, hopefully less. And after that, there's plenty of other things to do. So we still need to implement state syncing for Tendermint. So that means being able to not have to download the entire blockchain, but to just sync the state. And then the next step would be building bridges to other blockchains. So you can't use IBC as we will specify it to connect to Bitcoin and Ethereum and other proof of work networks because those don't use classical BFT consensus. But so we have to create an adapter layer. So we'll be working on that. And then we'll be working on helping partners so that they can build their own application and grow out this Cosmos network.
And you've also just launched Mainnet, which actually can take some blockchain projects a surprisingly long time. I mean, launching onto Mainnet or launching your own Mainnet. How long did you spend on Testnet, and what are some of the learnings you've taken to that mainnet launch that surprised you, didn't surprise you?
Good question. So, it's been a long time coming. So, I didn't think it would take years, but that's how long it took. Tendermint Tendermint started off as originally a public blockchain project that later became an agnostic, like a general purpose consensus engine. So in a sense, it's been 4.5 years coming, but the Cosmos concept only started around early 2017 or late 2016. And the latest testnet was the game of stakes. And that was an incentivized testnet. It was the first time we really used Tendermint in a public setting with over 100 active validators. So at one point there were 200 validators, and that was pretty exciting to see because I don't think a classical, pure classical BFT engine or consensus algorithm had been used in that kind of setting before. So it was exciting to see that. What I learned is that when there's excitement from the community on such a system, then they start helping each other to get everyone up to speed. So and then the network starts to take a life of its own. So it was very exciting to see everyone help each other and very quickly learn the ropes, even though the software isn't completely polished yet, right? So it's great to see that. What else? We've learned that the software is reasonably robust. So it's exciting to see that the main net is still going live and strong. But I'm sure we have a lot more lessons to learn. We'll find out when we encounter more fires, which I'm sure will happen.
That all sounded very positive. So I'm now going to ask one final question, which is often the could take the wind out your sails. It's sometimes the negative question for a lot of blockchain projects. So you mentioned a lot of positives there, but apart from the test projects, how many applications are running on Tendermint networks right now? Or I guess the caveat there being you've only just launched a mainnet and probably you weren't encouraging people to develop production applications on a testnet, but are there many? Are many people building applications to run on Tendermint?
Yeah, there's quite a lot. Actually, we find out about most of the applications sometime, you know, after someone, you know, gives us a hint or something, you know, that they're using Tendermint. So, for example, like Loom has a deployment, a production deployment using Tendermint. But that's just one example. I mean, there's Iris, which is it's a microservices directory that launched just before the Cosmos Hub launched in based in Hong Kong in Asia. There's, you know, various other applications that are live as well.
That was my interview with Jaequan of Tendermint. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you enjoyed the interview and the links. You can find out more on previous episodes at christiangiller.com/podcasts, where you can also @support buy merchandise, make donations, all those wonderful things. There is a newsletter connected with this show at /newsletters. And I will be releasing a new newsletter, mostly automated, but created by me and a couple of other people on ethics in technology very, very soon. So keep an eye on the newsletters page to see that. I'm also recording the first episode of my new show, The Enthusiastic Amateur, next week. That might take a little bit of time for production, but keep an eye out for that on the podcast page too. The first episode will be about computer history. I'm going to be speaking to the creator of the 2Bit blog, and we are going to be digging into computing history and what you need to know to win over dinner parties. Finessing the tagline, but that's kind of roughly the idea. I would love to hear from you. Please rate, review, share the show, and let me know if you have any thoughts or questions at Chris Chinch on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on the Facebook page, wherever you found this show. And yet again, if you have been, thank you very much for listening.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. It's John LeFoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunch Berry.
No!
No one steals my Crunch Berries.
I think you mean my Crunch Berries. Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota. So little time.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.